Let's continue our study of how things worked out for Herod, the king of the Jews, becoming such a prominent player in the gospel story. We know that he was declared king of the Jews by the Roman Senate in 40 BC because they thought that he would be the best person to deal with the Parthian invasion of the Jewish kingdom under the manipulations of Antigonus, the usurper, to the high priesthood and ethnarchy of that place. And so Herod arrives in the latter part of 40 BC, supported by Romans as well as his own troops, tries to get Antigonus and the Parthians to give up and move out, but that doesn't happen. And so Herod spends a few years with his forces basically ejecting all of those that are supporting Antigonus and the Parthians out of the country, killing them if that is what it takes. And that included a whole bunch of the gangs, the Jewish gangs, that were barricaded up in the Galilean highlands, up in the caves there. So that brings us around to 37 BC. The Parthians have pretty much been beaten. The outlying Jewish regions are under Herod's control. And Herod, who is in his mid-30s, feels it is now time to begin his siege of the city of Jerusalem. Now, that siege was particularly effective because a sabbatical year had happened the year previous, that is, from the fall of 38 into the spring of 37, which is what we're talking about right now. And so there were only supplies from the previous years, grains and agricultural products available. And so shutting these guys up in Jerusalem really made them eat up what little supplies they had left. Herod chose at this very moment, when he felt that he was about to become the ruler at Jerusalem, to consummate his betrothed marriage to Mariamne, who was the granddaughter of Hyrcanus, and therefore the princess of this Hasmonean royal line. And the next thing that happens is that on the anniversary of Pompey entering Jerusalem 27 years earlier, Herod is able to break into the city. And so this is the information that we have from Josephus's writings. I'm going to just read it to you. Wars of the Jews, Book 1, Chapter 18. Now the multitude of the Jews that were in the city were divided into several factions, for the people that crowded about the temple, being the weaker part of them, gave it out that at the time, as the times were, he was the happiest and most religious man who should die first. But as to the more bold and hardy men, they got together in bodies and fell a robbing others after various manners, and these particularly plundered the places that were about the city, and this because there was no food left either for the horses or the men. So that's the effects of the siege and the famine brought on by the sabbatical year being in force. The people inside the besieged city of Jerusalem are starting to effectively cannibalize one another, not eating one another's bodies, but stealing one another's supplies and fighting against one another. And many of them felt like they had no choice but to die fighting. And so, continuing now with Antiquities of the Jews, Book 14, Chapter 16, This destruction befell the city of Jerusalem when Marcus Agrippa and Cananius Gallus were consuls at Rome on the 185th Olympiad on the third month, so that's the third Jewish month of 37 BC, on the solemnity of the fast. And we talked about this when Pompey took the city. There was some sort of fast going on. And the guess of some is that it was taking place toward the end of the month, maybe in relationship to a historical event way back at the split between Judah and Israel. But anyway, back to the text. It says, this took place on the third month on the solemnity of the fast, as if a periodical revolution of calamities had returned since that which befell the Jews under Pompey, for the Jews were taken by him on the same day. And this was after 27 years' time. So the city has now been broken into. And then the non-Jewish military members under Herod start plundering the city of its public and private wealth. They were even attempting to get into the temple shrine building and take anything of value from there. And Herod was very upset by this because they were plundering his kingdom effectively, his people. And so Herod managed to stop this behavior by promising that he would pay every soldier under his command a large cash bonus from his own monies if they would just not plunder the city. Now, keep in mind, Herod has been a Roman citizen for quite a few years now, and he has been, as an added bonus, rewarded to him and his family by Julius Caesar, tax immune. So he's never had to pay any taxes for the last decade or so. And he's able to take all of his money and invest it and get big returns. So he is massively wealthy, very independently wealthy. So he can promise this and carry it out. And everybody knows that. So Antigonus ends up being captured. He's transported to Antioch, Syria, where Mark Antony is. And there he is beheaded by Mark Antony as an enemy of the Roman people, of the Roman Senate. Because I'm going to remind you again, all of this military action is happening because the Romans are exercising their responsibility as the allies of the Jewish people. And they have a treaty that's over 100 years old that anyone that usurps the Jewish throne, the Jewish leadership, becomes an automatic enemy of the Roman Republic. And so Antigonus is gone now, had his head chopped off, perhaps because he also was a Roman citizen, by the way. So Josephus believed that perhaps a bribe by Herod may have ensured that he ended up being executed and not simply captured, sent to Rome, maybe sent into exile. And so Antigonus was the last male Hasmonean to rule over the country of Judea, the country of the Jews. And so that is why Antiquities, Book 14, chapter number 16, Josephus makes this notation. And thus did the government of the Hasmoneans cease, 126 years after it was first set up. And when you run the numbers on that, you find out that Josephus is actually counting Judas Maccabee as the first of the Hasmonean leaders, as the high priest and ethnarch of the Jews. Back to the quotation. This family was a splendid and an illustrious one, both on account of the nobility of their stock and of the dignity of the high priesthood, as also for the glorious actions their ancestors had performed for our nation. These men lost the government by their dissensions one with another. Notice that Josephus, even a couple of generations later, is still blaming Hyrcanus and Aristobulus and their argument over which of them should be the Jewish leader. It was their fault that the war got started, which the Romans got sucked into, which then resulted in the end of the Hasmonean dynasty. And so, but these men lost the government by their dissensions one with another, and it came to Herod, the son of Antipater, who was of no more than a vulgar family. The word vulgar here means common, meaning not of the royalty, and of no eminent extraction, but one that was subject to other kings. His point, Josephus's point being, Herod was not from a Jewish family, he was from an Idumean family, and in all practical points, Herod, as king of the Jews, answered to the Roman Senate as his boss. And this is what history tells us was the end of the Hasmonean family. Herod, in 37, arranged for Hyrcanus to be brought back to Jerusalem from Parthia. Because remember, he had his earlobe bitten off by Antigonus back in 40. And then he was apparently carted off as a prisoner of the Parthian people up to Babylonia area, up to Mesopotamia. But while he was there, he'd apparently become the beloved leader of the Jewish population. Even though he couldn't function as high priest, they treated him with all the respect that was due that office. Herod arranges for Hyrcanus to come back to Jerusalem because, under Josephus's mind, that would appear to offer some stamp of approval for Herod's leadership. Because if Hyrcanus is there supporting Herod, then that's going to be better for Herod's authority. Now, since Hyrcanus could no longer serve as high priest because he's been disfigured by having his earlobe bit off, Herod arranges for an old friend of his, an old acquaintance of his, named Anellus, to become the new high priest. This guy was also living in Babylon, for whatever reason, and so he's brought to Jerusalem to become the high priest. Now, that did not go over well with Herod's mother-in-law, who is the daughter of Hyrcanus. She wanted her young son, Aristobulus III, that would be Mariamne's little brother and Herod's brother-in-law. He's in his mid-teens right now, 16 or so years of age. So Herod's mother-in-law wanted that young man, Aristobulus III, to be declared high priest instead, because he was of this special line of the Hasmoneans. So Alexandra, that's her name, she wrote letters to her good friend Cleopatra VII of Egypt. Yes, that Cleopatra, Mark Antony's Cleopatra. So she writes letters to Cleopatra asking her to influence Mark Antony. And of course, you know, Mark Antony and Cleopatra are having a love affair at this point, to convince Herod to appoint his brother-in-law to the high priestly office. So mom is putting pressure on her friend in Egypt to put pressure on her friend, Mark Antony, to put pressure on Herod to appoint Aristobulus, the 16 or 17-year-old, as high priest. Well, at the prompting of a member of Mark Antony's Syrian court, Delius, who was on business in Jerusalem, she, Alexandra, also sent sketches of her son and her daughter, Mariamne, Princess Mariamne, to Mark Antony along with the request. Now, when you read Josephus, the sense is that she was trying to give Mark Antony a visual picture of how beautiful this royal family was that had kind of been shoved to the side by Mark Antony and Octavian and the Roman Senate declaring Herod to be the king of the Jews. And so wouldn't it only be fair that some compensation is made here, that at least the high priesthood should stay inside this beautiful family of the Hasmoneans? Well, that little side plot kind of backfired on Alexandra because of this. This is from Antiquities, Book 15, Chapter 2. Delius also talked extravagantly and said that these children seem not derived from men, but from some god or other. See, that's how beautiful they were. His design in doing so was to entice Antony into lewd pleasures with them, who was ashamed to send for the damsel as being the wife of Herod, and avoided it because of the reproaches he should have had from Cleopatra on that account. But he sent in the most decent manner he could for the young man, but added this withal, unless he thought it hard upon him to do so. Okay, so we find out in history here, and I think a few other places, that Mark Antony might have swung both ways. And so he was maybe bisexual. And so the implication from Josephus is that when Mark Antony gets these pictures, he feels a burning desire for these beautiful young people, and he can't very well get Mariamne because she's married to King Herod. But he might be able to have something going on with the young man. And so he sends to have him brought to him. And Herod, of course, has to step in at this point. When this letter was brought to Herod, he did not think it safe for him to send one so handsome as was Aristobulus in the prime of his life, for he was 16 years of age and of so noble a family, and particularly not to Antony, the principal man among the Romans, and one that would abuse him in his armors, and in his, that's amours, I should say, and besides, one that openly indulged himself in such pleasures as his power allowed him without control. So this is interesting. This is an interesting insight into Herod's mindset and his morality. He does not want to send his 16-year-old brother-in-law to Mark Antony because he figures that he's going to end up being abused. And he doesn't want that to happen to him. So instead, this is what he does. He therefore wrote back to him that if this boy should not should only go out of the country, all would be in a state of war and uproar, because the Jews were in hopes of a change in the government and to have another king over them. So he effectively says, look, Mark Antony, I can't send this young man your direction because he is still the hope of kingship for the people here in Judea. They want him to be the high priest. They want him to be their future king as a member of the Hasmonean line. Now, why would he say things like that? Well, Herod might have been open at this time with the idea that he would rule for a while as king of the Jews, and then, once his brother-in-law was old enough, turn that over to him and then become his right-hand supporter. Because after all, that is how his father, his brother, and himself had acted toward Hyrcanus when he was high priest and ethnarch of the Jews. And so they were good with that at that time. And so at this moment in Herod's mind, he may have been open to that idea, because this is early days of him acting as the king of the Jews. He's only been in control of Jerusalem for a matter of months at the most at this time. So after that incident and a little bit more nagging from his mother-in-law, Herod finally called a meeting of the Judean leaders, at which he slyly announced that his mother-in-law was conspiring by post, by letters, with Cleopatra VII and Mark Anthony to have him replaced as king of the Jews with her teenage son. So he just lays that all out there in front of the Jewish leadership. As he planned, as he'd expected, Alexandra, his mother-in-law, broke down in tears upon this accusation, which was at least partially true. She had been in contact with Cleopatra. She had tried to, through her, manipulate Mark Anthony in appointing her son, Aristobulus III, as the high priest. So she had been involved in all of that. So she broke down in tears. And then, denying that she ever wanted to deprive Herod of the kingship, but only wished to secure the high priesthood for her son. She then apologized to Herod and promised that she would cause no more trouble. And so Herod accepted her public apology and then appointed his young brother-in-law, Aristobulus III, as high priest. And so all of that happened in 37 BC. And so let's talk, as we're kind of wrapping up today, the political and the religious situation of Judea at this time in history, 37 BC. Gaius Julius Caesar Octavian is 26 years old. He's later going to be known as Augustus, but now we just call him Octavian. He was in control of the western half of the Roman Republic in 37 BC. Marcus Antonius, or Mark Anthony, who is 46 years of age, he is in control of the eastern half of the Roman Republic. And there's a little tension between the two of them, and that's why they've kind of come to this power-sharing arrangement. Cleopatra VII is 31 years of age. She is not Egyptian of ethnicity. She is of Greek descent. And she is ruling Egypt with an iron fist that has been put in place thanks to the Romans' support for her. And she has great influence over Mark Anthony as his lover. And she does not like Herod one tiny bit. Perhaps because of her friend Alexandra's attitude toward Herod. Herod has recently appointed his now 17-year-old brother-in-law, Aristobulus III, as the high priest, because of the insistence of her mother-in-law, Princess Alexandria of the Hasmonean line. He's also done it to protect Aristobulus from being taken away to Mark Anthony and possibly misused by him. Alexandra's father, the former high priest and former ethnarch of the Jews, Hyrcanus, is 74 years of age. He is the great-grandnephew of the famous Judas Maccabee, by the way. He was now living a private life in Jerusalem because he can't function as high priest, and the ethnarchy has now been superseded by the king of the Jews status of Herod the Great, given to him by the Roman Republic. Herod, because of all the things that have recently happened, has assigned, quote, an honor guard or security detail, end quote, to his mother-in-law. Basically secret service protection. But a large reason for this is because he doesn't trust her. He doesn't trust that she won't try to conspire against his kingship. So Alexandra complained in letters again to Cleopatra about this and tried to make arrangements to sneak her and her son out of Judea to Egypt in a pair of coffins. Very sly. But the plan ends up being revealed to Herod, who stops it from happening and doesn't take any further action. But he does keep in mind that she's still up to her old tricks. And then comes the Feast of Tabernacles at the end of the summer of 37, getting ready to go into the fall. The Jewish festival crowd responded in exuberance to this young high priest that does all of the ceremonies in the special robes that have now been form-fitted to him. And remember, he's a very beautiful figure, very handsome figure. And so the Jewish crowds are hailing him in such a way that Herod begins to suspect, you know what? I think they'd want him to be king now. And this makes him start acting in the jealous fashion that we know so well.